Call the House Committee on Judiciary order Tuesday, May 26, 2011. We're over the capacity in the room. I think you can have, what, six or seven when all the chairs are pulled up, are filled up. The rest of you will have to go up. The fire marshal will be coming in here. I want to make some announcements about the bills that will be rolled over so that you know. Senate Bill 519, we're going to have a short hearing on it today, and then it will be, but I'll do that later. 347, Senate Bill 347. Senate Bill...
Will it be carried over, Mr. Chair?
Yes,
is that what you're saying?
They're all being carried over.
Okay.
Senate Bill 401 is going to be a work group in the interim. We're not satisfied with where the insurance fraud is. We're going to work on that. That bill's done for the year. Senate Bill 405 is going to be held over. Senate Bill 557 is going to be held over. And I believe that's it. Until Tuesday, next Tuesday. Be aware that we've got quite a few bills. We've got three full days. If you want to talk too long, your bill will probably die. So if you want to talk it to death, that's what can happen. And I will not sacrifice other good bills because people can't limit their time. We'll have to stop your testimony. So I want you to take a look at we're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 424A.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, Senate Bill 424A has two real effects. First of all, it states that a driver commits the offense of, well, first of all, presently a driver commits the offense of failure to stop and remain stopped for a pedestrian entering a crosswalk if they do not stop for a pedestrian who's proceeding in accordance with a traffic control device or crosswalk. 424 modifies this definition by making explicit that this is meant to incorporate any part or extension of a pedestrian, including body, wheelchair, cane, crutch, etc. The other component of 424 creates, this is the what was called on the other side, the fill the boot exception to the offense of pedestrian with improper position upon a highway for individuals who do not impair traffic, post advance warning signs, wear high visibility safety apparel, and have been issued a permit to conduct fundraising activities on the roadway who would otherwise be guilty of the violation of obstructing that roadway.
Okay, I'd like to have Bob Livingston come up along, please. Unless you've got someone with you, Bob.
I have a gentleman from the MDA if there was technical questions, however you'd like to handle that, Mr. Chair.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Krieger, committee members. My name is Bob Livingston, representing the Oregon State Firefighters Council. I believe that committee staff is handing out a brief synopsis of why this bill is necessary. I will not go into details. I will make sure to keep with the chair's likings. In essence, what this bill would do is remove the sunset that was created in 2008 as it deals specifically with activities along or near a roadway. This will, by the passage of this bill, this will keep in check the 56-year partnership that we've had with Muscular Dystrophy Association to help find a cure for multiple neuromuscular diseases. We believe this has been a highly successful partnership. And if I could just very briefly turn your attention to the last couple of paragraphs. Over last year, we raised over $400,000. Over $1 million in 2007 went to places like Shriners Hospital and other hospitals to help find cures, as well as to help facilitate camp activities for kids that suffer from neuromuscular diseases. And so the bottom line, without this bill, the sunset provision of the bill that was passed in 2008 would go away, and in essence, we would not be able to do our fill-the-boot activities. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to answer any questions if you had, and would certainly support and ask for your support of Senate Bill 424A.
Okay, questions, committee?
Just to be clear, thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Mr. Livingston, you like Senate Bill 424 as it came to us from the Senate.
Chair Krieger, Representative Nolan, we believe I think this strikes a balance. I can't speak specifically to the other elements of the bill, but it seems a reasonable position, and I think there's others that would talk to that. Certainly, we want to have an expedient process to make sure that we don't lose our activity, and we need to have it soon.
Just to clarify, I like the fill-the-boot activity, and I think it's great, but you don't have any problem with the other elements of the bill. You may be neutral on them, but you don't have any problem with them, do you?
Chair Krieger, Representative Nolan, that's correct.
Thanks.
Don't have a boot with you, do you? You could make them fill it.
Be all right.
Mr. Chair, I think if people talk too long, you're going to give them the boot, ain't you?
I'm happy to leave if that's
okay, thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bob Jundoff, is it Jundoff? I can't remember.
Jundoff.
Nicole Armstrong.
Shall I start? Co-chairs, members of the committee, my name is Bob Jundoff. I'm the director of Disability Rights Oregon. Thank you for this opportunity to testify on this important bill. Senate Bill 432 would clarify Oregon law to make sure that...
Wrong bill?
424.
I know you'll appreciate my testimony on the other bill.
He signed up for two of them.
Did you sign up for two?
I did indeed.
They had up on you.
And I'm off to a very rocky start, I recognize, and I know that I have a time limit. So, Senate Bill 424 addresses in its sections 1 and 2 the challenge that people with disabilities have when they're presented with crossing traffic. In a perfect world, everyone could be treated equally at a crosswalk. However, when a person with disabilities is confronted with a crosswalk, sometimes they are in a situation in which there is not a curb cut if they're using a wheelchair, so that it's difficult to get from the sidewalk down to the street surface. Sometimes that is a very steep descent, so that it's difficult to stop. Sometimes traffic signals are not available for those people to have access to. It's difficult for drivers to see on turns. Sometimes drivers aren't paying attention. But one thing is pretty consistent is that because of a disability, people don't have the type of reaction time, the ability to adjust their behavior and respond to situations the way that an able-bodied person might be able to do so. In preparation for this hearing, I just went around my office. In addition to serving people with disabilities, we have people with disabilities on our staff and volunteers. Both of the women in my office who use wheelchairs have both been struck by automobiles in crossing on crosswalks. And I just asked them to tell me about it. And in one situation, it was downtown in Portland, and the person was just crossing a street, and a van took a left-hand turn and just went right into her, just because in the wheelchair she's a little bit lower and just didn't see her. In the other circumstance, which happened in Gresham, our employee was at an intersection in which there was a button to push in order to stop all lights so that she could cross the street. That button was about was out of her reach. She's in a motorized wheelchair. She couldn't reach to find the button, to press the button, and so she inched her way out into the street, waited till she didn't see any cars, and proceeded, and a car again coming around the corner struck her and injured her. These are just two examples of the types of challenges that people have in trying to cross streets, and this is why we feel that the modest changes and clarifications contained in Senate Bill 424 are appropriate. We are also thrilled that our firefighters are collecting money for services for people with disabilities, and so that's why we think that this bill in its entirety represents the best of Oregon, people who are being careful, being generous, and taking the time and effort to help people who need some extra help. Thank you.
Chair Krieger, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Nicole Armstrong. I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon Association of Area Agencies on Aging and Disabilities, O4AD. We're here in support of the engrossed version of Senate Bill 424 for all of the reasons that Mr. June Deff had just said. We just add older adults to that list of individuals that have challenges sometimes as they're trying to proceed in a crosswalk. We live in a very impatient society, and we have a lot of impatient drivers, and any clarification that can help individuals continue their independence, continue to be as able-bodied as possible, continue to want to choose to walk and be out there in the public. We are supportive of that. We are also, as Mr. June just said, supportive of the other half of the bill that continue to support the Fill the Boot efforts. So we would appreciate your support in moving this bill. Thank you.
Yeah, just briefly, thank you. How does this help? How does this bill, what changes will help? I mean, how do you see this changing from current law to improve it?
Representative Barker, I don't see this as necessarily changing the law, but clarifying the law, in that the present language is a bit vague in terms of when a person is considered to enter into an intersection. And in this situation, a person, for example, who is blind and using a cane, if that cane enters into the intersection, that would trigger the protections of the law. If a person has a wheelchair, if part of that chair or a crutch or a cane enters into the intersection, that would trigger the protections. If the person has an assistance animal that is leading them out into traffic, once that assistance animal comes into the crosswalk, then we trigger the protections.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't have any problem with your change. I don't have any problem with, you know, a foot, a cane, a wheelchair, a dog. But I got to tell you, we not only do we have impatient drivers, we have distracted pedestrians. We have pedestrians that aren't using common sense who use this crosswalk as some kind of false sense of security. Now, I'm for them. I'm not for changing the law. I have no problem with this change here. But, you know, up in Portland, there's people up there that just step right out saying, I got a right to move and step in front of your truck. Well, that's fine, but gravity is not forgiving. And my daughter crosses our street every day to get on the bus, and they have one of those things, they have stop sign, and I make sure, she's 17 years old, she still looks up the road and down the road every single day when I watch her, because that's what I told her, because they drive like maniacs down that street. And the false sense of security we're giving people with this, I think causes a lot of these accidents, and then they blame it on an impatient driver. Sometimes it is, sometimes it isn't. I have no problem with this amendment, but I think we need to stress people have to look both ways, and tons of metal will not stop on a dime. Thank you for letting me lecture, Mr. Chair. I know you're going to give me the boot if I go on.
I would say, you know, you got three retired cops up here that understand this, and coming and going daily to this building, I hate to think how many bushel baskets of tickets I could give to pedestrians and cars both. We already have enough laws on the books to take care of all this problem, but they're not being enforced. And that's something I think that Representative Barker and I can get together on and perhaps have some of the police agencies come in. I mean, it's daily. And I throw up my hands, you know. You get out here in this main street, you got three or four lanes, two cars stop, pedestrian starts across, the guy in this lane keeps running and going because he's not paying attention. Next intersection, you're doing 30 miles an hour, you can, and all of a sudden, boom, off the walk comes someone. They can see you coming, and like Representative Schaffer is saying, they need to also be aware of their own safety and not assume that a car doing 30 miles an hour can stop at some of these uncontrolled intersections. It's this bill, I noticed how it came out with 12 no votes in the Senate. It wasn't because we don't want to protect vulnerable people. It's that there's a balance, and I think the balance isn't taking place because neither side is being held accountable. Anything further? Okay, thank you. Jeff Mandel, Todd Markowitz, and Nicholas John, is it Johnson? Please.
Correct.
Or do you want just to identify yourselves, please?
Hi, Representative Krieger. My name is Jeff Mandel. I submitted some testimony, written testimony. I also sent the same testimony by email. Basically, it's a story of, it's my personal story about crosswalk tragedy, and there's no shortage of crosswalk tragedies, but my wife was struck while crossing in the crosswalk on her way to work. She was seriously injured, and the driver who hit her was convicted for failure to stop and remain stopped for a pedestrian in the crosswalk. And I think that the language that's proposed in this bill does help clarify how a pedestrian can signal their intention to cross the street. And I believe that that clarity in the language will also make it clearer for drivers when they're looking for signals that a pedestrian is trying to cross the street. And I think in your point about law enforcement, Representative Krieger, that law enforcement does need clear guidelines when enforcing the law. And more clarity is better in that case. Where the language is explicit, law enforcement has a firm foundation to enforce. So I would urge that I would urge you to support this bill, as I believe that the language does help make everyone's role in the roadway clearer for both pedestrians, drivers, and even law enforcement. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Co-Chairs Krieger and Barker and members of the committee. My name is Todd Borkowitz, and I'm a resident of Oregon's House District 43 and a former member of the Willamette Pedestrian Coalition. I'm writing to express my overwhelming support for Senate Bill 424 and ask for your vote in support of this bill that I believe will help clarify Oregon's crosswalk laws, reducing roadway injuries and fatalities. As an urban designer and Oregon registered landscape architect, I regularly design spaces that improve public health, safety, and welfare for Oregon residents. In doing so, I believe in the important role of sound design and policies, as well as straightforward laws that minimize confusion, thereby creating public spaces that are safer for all users. Oregon's most common public spaces, our roadways, can be made safer with better clarification of Oregon law. As an active walker and runner, I personally witness and experience regular instances on roadways in my own neighborhood where my personal safety or that of fellow pedestrians is compromised due to driver or bicyclist uncertainty of whether a person is crossing a street. Likewise, as an occasional driver and bicyclist, I would benefit from understanding a pedestrian's clear intent to cross the street that I'm driving on or riding on to trigger their crosswalk rights instead of having them step into the roadway to do so and thereby creating an unsafe traffic situation. Senate Bill 424 makes sense to me. It provides clarity to an existing Oregon law whose ambiguity creates confusion and uncertainty to many roadway users. While I consider myself a relatively agile and able to quickly remove myself from dangerous situations, I do regularly fear crossing certain streets and would imagine that this perceived and real danger is much greater for people with disabilities as well as our seniors and our children. Thank you for the opportunity to share my opinion on Senate Bill 424, a bill that I believe makes travel safer for all Oregonians. Thanks.
Okay. You're next.
My name is... Is there a mic? Pardon me. My name is Nicholas Johnson. I'm from Portland, Oregon. I'm also on the Portland Commission on Disability. I'm a commissioner, and also I'm a member of the National Federation of the Blind. As far as the Blind Committee community, it's imperative that this bill get passed, because we don't have the same luxury as visual sight that you guys do. You're right, when we do proceed into a crosswalk or at a cross intersection, we're taught how to wave our cane before we go in. This happened way before this law came out. This is an instruction on how they teach us how mobility instruction. Also, to get across the street, we don't, if there's all the signs, all the crosswalks, they don't make noises. So we have to go by the motion of the traffic. We go by the motion of the traffic. If the traffic is going this way and we're walking across the street this way, then we have to go with the flow of traffic. And usually we're taught when we get to an intersection, and if we're trying to cross that intersection and the traffic is going that way because we can't see, we're told to wait there because we don't see how much time is left up on the crosswalk. Wait until the traffic goes, it goes the other way, and then wait again. We're taught to be patient because our lives depend on us following the laws to the letter of the law. I've lost 3 brothers that are visually impaired in the last 5 years because not they didn't follow the law, but because somebody ran into the intersection. Last week when I was being introduced to this bill at the Portland Commission on Disability, that same day that I was going down there, somebody proceeded into the crosswalk. I'm already walking across, and they're proceeding in it. They've blocked it, and they refuse to back up. They got the window down. I'm not going to back up. Just go around. Just go around the front. Well, I had to go around the front into Sandy Boulevard, into traffic. And it was very hazardous because that's the way the traffic was flowing. So I've had other incidences where I've had 3 canes broken, one due to a bicyclist running into it and running over it. The other one was where a car ran through the intersection and hit my cane. These incidences are common occurrences. We have what we call defensive walking for the blind, and that may sound funny, but that's how we have to walk. We have to walk defensively. We can't just proceed out into traffic like we got bumpers and we're hoping the traffic's going to stop, because we don't know where it's coming from. We don't know how big the vehicle is. We don't know who's going to stop, because a lot of times, even when we do have the right of way and other traffic has stopped, somebody else has run the light, and we've lost members that way. So I ask you to consider passing this bill, not because of there's a lot of people that are asking for it, because it's a safety need. And I know in some areas, whether you have high traffic volume downtown, like especially in Portland, when walking downtown, I have to go by the flow of traffic. I don't go by the pedestrians because a lot of them jaywalk. And I got caught up into that flow when I moved from Salem up into Portland. It's a different land site up there. You have different animals up there. They think differently. And so it took me a while to be accustomed to how they are. So I have to adjust. And a lot of people that are visually impaired have to adjust and make accommodations in the traffic areas. High traffic areas sometimes are so high, we're taught to avoid them. Because of the amount of accidents that occur. So I just like to reiterate to please consider in passing this bill on safety procedures, and it will save lives.
Mr. Chair, I don't know what the definition of driver of a vehicle is, but in light of this testimony right here, this should include bicycles. They run somebody down and hurt them bad, too. That's just my humble suggestion.
Bicycles have to obey, if I may, Mr.
Okay,
Chair.
Okay,
bicycles
you.
Are required to obey traffic laws. So
okay, thank you very much for clarifying that, Mr.
Any
Chair.
Any further questions, committee? Okay, thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It looks like Steph Ralph, Marina Wilojek, and Holly McRae. Excuse me a minute before you come up. I want to have Representative Hoyle come up. Come up first, let her testify. As soon as she's done the three I just called, can come up.
Excuse me
for not getting you up here.
Oh, no, that's okay. This was fascinating testimony, so it was a great opportunity to listen to people speak. I would like to thank you very much for hearing me today. My name is Val Hoyle, and I represent House District 14, West Eugene, and Junction City. I am here today to speak very briefly in support of this bill. I've talked to a number of our local police officers, and what they have said is that this will help them in their process of educating people on how to stay safe in crosswalks. 2 years ago, we lost a middle schooler, one of my son's classmates, in a crosswalk accident. And as my good colleague from Happy Valley has said, you cannot legislate common sense. But if there's something that we can do, just a small thing, to help people be safe, to make it clear what people need to do when they walk into a crosswalk, to help motorists understand when they need to stop, I think that this is something we should do. The other thing is, many of you know, I am a daughter of a firefighter. I am the niece of a number of firefighters, police officers, state troopers. And when I talk to my local police force, and they say, you know what, this would help us do our job better. And when I speak to our local firefighters, and, you know, we have the boot program. My father used to go out and collect money for muscular dystrophy, and it is a great program. This bill will do two things. One, it will allow our firefighters to support people with muscular dystrophy. This will also help us keep our pedestrians safe and our motorists understanding what their responsibilities are as drivers. So I hope that you will pass this good legislation.
Any questions, Representative?
Thank you.
I'll let you off easy. Thank you.
Thank you for that.
I called up Steph Roth, Marina Wilojek, and Holly McRae. I'll get to hear how you pronounce your names.
Hello, Co-Chairs Barker and Krieger. Thank you very much for having us here today. My name is Steph Ralph. I'm the director of the Willamette Pedestrian Coalition, and we are very much in favor of, in support of this bill, 424. I think most people have said more eloquently than I could what I meant to, but on the second page of my written testimony, I just want to call out related to, and I'm so glad that you mentioned that all road users have a great responsibility on our roadways, and towards the end, just to read this part of the testimony, people who are walking have a responsibility to keep themselves and others safe as well, which the crosswalk safety bill does not diminish in the slightest. A pedestrian is still at fault if he or she suddenly leaves a curb or other place of safety and moves into the path of a vehicle that is so close as to constitute an immediate hazard. The WPC works with law enforcement agencies and with local partners on education for pedestrian legal clinics to demonstrate and describe people's responsibilities as pedestrians as well as cyclists and drivers, and we feel that this bill will help us and our partners in law enforcement, including the Hillsborough Police Department and Portland Police Bureau that have come out in favor, as a clear way of helping to educate all road users what their responsibilities are to make everyone safe. And I thank you, and I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you. Either one of you, please.
Thank you. I can go.
Hello, my name is Holly McCray, and I live in Eugene, Oregon, and I'm also a member of the chair of the Bicycle and Pedestrian Advisory Committee for the City of Eugene. Unfortunately, Eugene just earned the title on Tuesday by a report by Transportation for America. It named the Eugene-Springfield metro area as the most dangerous for the number of preventable pedestrian deaths in Oregon. I've not always been an advocate for active transportation options. 5 years ago, something happened that entirely changed the way I view everything, and that thing was I became a mom, and I started looking at the world quite differently. I started pushing my daughter around on strollers through our neighborhoods and noticing that the sidewalks just didn't quite connect. I didn't have good connections. Then when she started walking and riding her own bike, started recognizing how difficult crossings were. And this year she started kindergarten, and I became the school's coordinator for walking and biking activities. And every single morning, her and I stand there at the crosswalk during school hours and wait and wait and wait for cars to stop for us. And it's so challenging when you're trying to teach a child how to be a responsible pedestrian, and the law is somewhat vague. And I keep hearing this from many parents who say, I'd love to teach my child how to cross streets safely, but I don't really understand the law. It's critical that pedestrians have a clear signal that they can use to alert motorists of their intent to cross safely for the safety of all roadway users. So this morning, instead of standing on the corner of 24th and Adams watching cars pass by over and over again, my daughter and I boarded a train so that we could come here this morning and so that I could urge you to support Senate Bill 424 to clarify Oregon's crosswalk laws, which I believe will take a giant step towards improving safety for all pedestrians. Thank you for the opportunity.
Dear committee members, my name is Marina Hayek, and this is my son, Václav Hayek, who was... I was trying to be struck.
It's all right, take your time.
On August 27, 2007, he was killed. He was waiting to cross the street, the road, Bailey Hill Road. Thank you. He was waiting to cross Bailey Hill Road that used to be two lanes in the same direction, just a stretch of 300 meters, when the rest of the road was just one lane each direction, badly designed. A crosswalk that almost faded, traffic wouldn't stop. I crossed that crosswalk so many times with my children, and waiting, one time I had to wait 5 minutes for the traffic to stop for us. My son went to water his pumpkin patch to the community garden on the 27th and never came back. He was waiting to cross the street. There was not too much traffic. There was coming a car going south on the left lane that slowed down and eventually stopped, as the witness say, and let him cross, even wave to him to persuade him to cross the street. Behind her, on the right lane, nobody was coming, and nobody was coming on the opposite direction. Behind her, there were three other vehicles. The last one was a 16-year-old that I don't think should be behind the wheel. He got impatient as he approached the cars that were behind this lady and accelerated to reach 65 miles an hour in the area of 35. Got on the right lane, accelerated, and then tried to get back to the left lane when he realized that my son was there, and he struck him. He left 225 feet of skin and marks. That was the end of my son's beautiful life. When he died, I promised to him that this wouldn't be left alone, another case just put in a file and forgotten. The kid who killed him was charged of negligence homicide, just 8 days in jail, 4 weekends, community work. He couldn't even do the community work because it was too emotional for him. Then his license was revoked. And we ask about his community work that he didn't serve because of emotional reasons. He needed to give a speech to address his classmates and talk about his experience. His classmates just laugh about him, show no respect, no consideration. The community got together. We were new in town. We just moved that year a few months before. And we were happy to go to Eugene, thinking from California, where we never had a problem with the traffic, thinking, oh, the green estate and green areas, outdoors programs, friendly towards bicyclists for our children would be great. We get there, and a few months after that, my son gets killed. It needed to have two changes to happen, so the community got together, and members of the community also lead me to do the changes. The city converted that, transformed the road into one lane each direction and a safety intelligent crosswalk with push buttons that flash light to make the vehicles aware that the kids are going to cross, and a media in between the two lanes was installed in the area where my son got hit. There are more changes needed. Every time I send my daughter to the street, I have the idea that she's playing the Russian roulette, see who gets across the street and gets alive to the other side. When this bill came out and I was informed, it just answered my questions to when does a pedestrian has, how the pedestrian has to signal or do for the traffic to respect their way. Many times I stand on the crosswalks waiting for traffic to stop, to make sure that they are aware that we are there and let us cross. I tell my daughter, you look both ways, but you have to make sure your intentions for you to cross the street to the traffic. Make it clear. And this, if she is to put part of her foot into the street, is going to signal the traffic, and this will be clear and tell the police department something they can base on to follow the rules as well as the pedestrians. We have done many changes, but we still do. I got involved with the Safe Routes to School programs to make sure that the middle school where my children were going were learning about safety, something that is not being taught in the schools. And sometimes we don't bring it out to our children, besides when we are riding and walking with them, but we forget that there is the traffic and there are other individuals that forget about the laws and the rules. So we need to make changes. And this law, I'm asking you, please, this bill to pass, because it's really the answer for a safer way for pedestrians. The children today who are pedestrians will be drivers tomorrow. So it's very important that we start from when they are very young to educate them about safety and consideration towards others. Thank you.
Committee members, any questions? Thank you very much. We have two more that have signed up. Jonathan, is it Manton? I can't.
Anna Ritchie, and then Yvonne Smith. I grew up in the South, so I think ladies first is appropriate.
Okay, thank you. Can everybody hear me?
Yes.
Okay. My name's Yvonne Smith, and I'm from Portland, Oregon. I'm here for in support of Senate Bill 424 for both personal and professional reasons. I am a nearly four-year survivor, a victim of pedestrian vehicle collision, which took my legs, albeit there were extenuating circumstances, namely drugs and alcohol. But as a person now who uses either a manual wheelchair with help or a power wheelchair, and I'm learning to use legs with crutches, I live in Portland, and I live in between, on Southeast 64th, in between Southeast Foster and Powell, near 82nd, which is one of the big hotspots for pedestrian fatalities, actually in the nation. And so, and I do take my power chair out in that area. And so this is a situation where, my doctor said to me yesterday, why wouldn't this law be important? Because once you're out in the road and people see you, it's too late for them to stop. And especially with the situation where people are busy and not paying attention, especially if you have pedestrians not paying attention and drivers not paying attention. If you've got a law in place that says this is when you need to notice, then people at least have the opportunity to start noticing. And so I have actually a brief anecdote, which is that we were on our way here, and we went to there's a new safety crosswalk in place near 82nd and Foster, and as we were approaching, a woman in a power wheelchair just shot out into that intersection. She didn't push the buttons. She probably couldn't reach them, because I have had that experience, and just shot out in front of us. We weren't speeding. We were able to slow down and stop, but this is a situation that just goes on every single day, and not just in the cities, as we heard, also in the rural areas. The second thing that I do in my profession has been as a skill trainer, both for children with disabilities and also as some driver's ed and independent living skills for foster children and children who have grown up in chaotic households. And I was going to point out that every law is an opportunity for education. And a law such as this gives the opportunity for people with disabilities, pedestrians, anybody crossing the street to be trained how and when to be aware, how to signal. And it's a huge opportunity to train young drivers and anybody getting a driver's license how and when to look out for pedestrians. So even though it seems like something as small as putting a crutch into the street and asking people to notice sounds like a small thing, it can be like a pebble falling in a pond, because with education we can broaden everybody's horizons and perhaps make some kind of a small dent in the huge epidemic of pedestrian vehicle fatalities in this state. Thank you for hearing me.
Members of the committee, my name is Jonathan Manton, co-chairs Krieger and Barker. I appreciate your time greatly today, and I'll be very, very quick. I get to be here every day, so I can talk to you further about this as necessary. But I just wanted to point out, I passed out some testimony with some support letters that I hope you'll take a look at. You know, we've had a great conversation today, and it's my opinion that this bill will actually reduce aggressive pedestrians as well as provide the other benefits that we've talked about, some of the conversation we've had. And I want to just quickly say why I think that. It's the current law right now with the word crossing, that you have to be crossing in the crosswalk to effectively assert your right of way. So by changing it the way that we're proposing today, it would essentially, it would be saying that part of the body plus intent to the cross is what you need to do as a pedestrian. You don't need to go jumping out in front of traffic. What you should do is just put part of your body in the crosswalk with the intent to cross. It's basically, as I'm trying to put it into common words myself, I think it's like the edging out law, which is what most of us do anyway on the crosswalk. We start to edge out a little bit, and we look to see if the cars are stopping. And so this would just clarify current law so that that's what would be the responsibility of the pedestrian. And then finally, I just want to mention a quote from Captain Todd Wyatt, as a traffic division of the Portland Police Bureau, who speaks to the enforcement and education components that we've heard a lot of talk about today. And that quote is, from an enforcement perspective, this law will be a big improvement. We believe that this legislation will make our education efforts with motorists and pedestrians easier. This legislation is important to note, would work only... Okay, that's all that I wanted to say. From an enforcement perspective, this law will be a big improvement. We believe that this legislation will make our education efforts with motorists and pedestrians easier. And that's from the law enforcement officers who are doing this all the time, as well as you guys have. So thank you very much for your time and attention to this issue.
Committee members, any questions of the witnesses? Okay, thank you very much. Folks, we are 45 minutes into this bill. We have six to go. We're going to close the public hearing on now and carry it over. We're carrying over 424 until Tuesday. Work session closed. Going to open a work session on Senate Bill 432.
Chairman of the committee, Senate Bill 432 requires a court, when calculating the maximum time a person may be committed in an aid and assist proceedings from when the defendant is first committed, and to give the defendant credit against each charge alleged in the accusatory instrument. And I believe this is a bill that Mr. Jundorf would like to testify on.
Yes, Bob. You're still here. And Mark Mistrom and Andy Smith, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Bob Junda from Disability Rights Oregon. I apologize for handing out my testimony earlier. But Senate Bill 432 is one of a group of bills that started from some conversations that we had about a year ago, looking at how our system involving the criminal courts and the state hospital work. And there was a sense that there was some inefficiencies in how it works, and that we might be able to address some of those so that we can use our resources more wisely, use our precious state hospital beds more wisely. And that resulted in House Bill 3100 and 2701 and Senate Bill 420. This particular bill addressed a fairly rare circumstance, but one that has occurred enough that it felt that we need some clarification, and that has to do for people who are facing criminal charges in our criminal courts, and a judge has determined that that person is not mentally capable of going forward and facing their charges. When that happens in Oregon, as in all states, really, that person is sent for treatment, mental health treatment, in order to restore them to capacity so that they can come back to court, face criminal charges, and resolve them. From time to time, unfortunately, what happens is that a person who has been stabilized in the state hospital and returned to jail, when they get back to jail, they again decompensate or they get sick again. Sometimes that happens by the stressful nature of the jail. Sometimes it happens by the nature of the disease. Sometimes they don't get the proper medications that they need in the jail, and so they come back. We've seen cases in which that happens multiple times. 3 and 4 times a person bounces back and forth. Our state statute is unclear, however, in terms of how much time the state and the hospital have in order to restore somebody to capacity to face their charges. The way that our system works, and it works this way under Supreme Court mandate, is that when a person is held in a state hospital in order to return them to capacity, the state is supposed to do that to determine whether that person can face their charges, and then if they feel that they can, they have up to 3 years in order to accomplish that goal. At the end of that period of time, if the person isn't capable of facing their criminal charges, the U.S. Supreme Court has said, well, gee, you can't hold on to them forever, but what you can do at that point is you can move them into a different custody situation, which is civil commitment. If they're dangerous to self and others as a result of their mental illness, and put the dismiss the criminal charges without prejudice so that they can be brought again if that person is ready to face charges. In the circumstances when a person bounces back and forth, it has been unclear as to how much time is involved, and the way that it can be interpreted is that each new admission to the hospital starts a 3-year maximum clock going, so it can end up in circumstances in which there is no time limit for a person who can't be treated effectively. This bill would clarify that, in fact, per the Supreme Court's decisions and per our structure, The state hospital has a total of 3 years to get that person well, and if they're not well at the conclusion of 3 years, then that person needs to move over to a civil commitment status.
Whichever one wants to start.
For the record, my name is Mark Nystrom. I am the Human Services Policy Manager for the Association of Oregon Counties. Co-chairs Krieger and Barker, members of the committee, I'm here to testify in support of Senate Bill 432. Back in September, AOC, under the leadership of our President Janet Carlson, brought together the Oregon State Hospital Task Force to bring members of the Human Services and Public Safety Committees together to discuss and make recommendations from the for the AOC Legislative Committee regarding the second state hospital in Junction City. And while we didn't come to a position on that particular issue, we did come to an agreement on Senate Bill 432 and House Bill 3100, which is a related bill. I'd like to direct your attention to Attachment 1 in the packet that I gave you. That was our report from the task force. It just shows you all the different members who participated on the task force. So the task force supported the amendment or Senate, what's now Senate Bill 432, and it was passed through the Human Services and Public Safety subcommittees of the AOC body, and then the AOC Legislative Committee also endorsed it. So AOC supports Senate Bill 432. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Co-Chairs Krieger and Co-Chair Barker and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Andy Smith. I'm the legislative liaison with the Association of Community Mental Health Programs, and we represent local mental health authorities in Oregon's 36 counties, nine mental health organizations that work with the Oregon Health Plan, and one tribe. And my testimony today will be very brief, and that is that our association supports Senate Bill 432 as amended. We think that clarifying the clock with regard to the aid and assist situation is appropriate. We think that the bill will prevent situations where individuals are unnecessarily in situations of a prolonged legal limbo. And we would like to thank Mr. Jundeff and his organizations for keeping efforts on this bill alive. And thank you for the opportunity to testify today.
Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Jundeff, so help me understand. I know I was part of this, but as I'm reading through it again, I'm unclear. So there is a person who has committed to state hospital for aid and assist. It's decided that they can go back into the criminal justice system, into the Department of Corrections. They go there, they decompensate. You said this is a rare incident, but it does happen. So at what point does the process start to happen civilly committed? And I'm assuming that's what would happen after that happened several times, right?
Mr. Co-Chair, as Representative Tomei, there are two points at which a person can be referred to civil commitment. And one is if there's a determination by the hospital and the court that a person can never be restored to capacity. And that can happen with people who, for example, have brain injury or have intellectual disabilities that prevent them from having an opportunity to ever regain capacity. Then there's a second category, and those are people that the hospital feels can be restored with treatment, but they, after 3 years of attempting to do so, they've been unsuccessful. And the judge and the hospital agree that that person has not been able to be restored to capacity. At that point, now the court has the option to either dismiss the charges and let the person go, or to dismiss the charges and refer the person to civil commitment court for a determination of whether they are, as a result of a mental illness or what's called in our statute mental retardation, that the person needs institutionalization.
If I could clarify that, Mr. Chair, thank you. I'm talking about the person in the hospital has said they're okay now to go back to the criminal justice system. That's happened a couple of times. They did decompensate when they go back to the prison system. So the hospital, they go to the hospital, say, but we fixed them. They're okay now. And they go back to the criminal justice system. At what point does that seesawing go back and forth and stop, and then the civil commitment process starts.
Mr. Co-Chairs, Representative Tomei, once a person is returned to jail from the hospital to face their charges, that's when their charges should be resolved. But in order for that, and that could be by a plea, it can be by trial and conviction, but in order for the for a person either to accept a plea or to face trial, they, our Constitution requires that they understand what's going on.
Right.
If they can't do that, then the judge would refer them back to the state hospital because they're unable to do that. And what our laws say is that from arrest and arraignment, the state has 3 years in which, from the point at which a person is found unable to aid and assist, the state has a total of 3 years in order to try to restore them to capacity to face their charges. So that's when the clock starts running for the period of treatment from that first time at which the person sent to the hospital to try to get them better.
That would include, if I may, Mr. Chair, that would include the time they go back to the criminal justice system, and they're there for a period of time, they go back to the hospital. So it's the full period of three years this ping pong might be going back and forth several times, right?
3 years in the hospital. So
3 years in the hospital.
In the hospital.
Not included the time they're
correct.
In the criminal justice system.
Correct.
Then I am still unclear. So they're in the hospital a year. They go back to stand trial, but they're there a month. They go back to the hospital for another year. They go back to the criminal justice system for a month. They decompensate. So they go back for 6 months. Back to the justice system. So then what, tell me at what point, I'm still unclear, at what point then would they go through the civil commitment?
I think that what you have just described, Mr. Chair, Representative Tomei, I think what you've just described is a situation which a person has logged now 2.5 years of hospital time and a certain amount of time in jail. And if they got sent back to the hospital, there would then be an additional 6 months.
Got it. Six
that
months
the state would have in order
sure.
to restore. And the principle be
here's total.
Right. And the principle behind this is that the Supreme Court has said when a person is being held in state custody in a mental institution for the purpose of restoring them to face trial, that this cannot go on indefinitely, that there needs to be some time limit associated with it.
Thank you.
You're not going to move it off. You're not going to move it today. I'll get my questions offline.
Okay, Mr. Chairman of the Committee, Mr. Jones, if I remember correctly, when this bill was up before the Senate, it was on the same day with Senate Bill 420. Which is a very controversial bill as it relates to PSRB and the hospital. And I think at that time, maybe because of that other bill, the district attorneys expressed some concern about this bill. Have you had discussions with them since? Are they okay with the bill now, or is there still an issue here?
Mr. Co-Chairs, Mr. Taylor, as far as I know, the district attorneys have not had any objection to the substance of this bill. They were concerned that it not be an amendment to House Bill 3100 because they wanted that bill to come clean through without any additional amendments. But we have aired that this in front of them in numerous forum, and they've indicated, at least to me, that they don't have any objections to it.
Thanks, Mr. Co-Chair. Yeah, I agree we should set it over. I'm not seeing substantively where there would be I don't speak to the District Attorney's Association, believe it or not. sometimes I do. But I don't see where there'd be a substantive change. It's not that big of a change. Kind of surprising the courts haven't weighed in on this one already. I mean, if the person is in custody, then chances are, I don't know if there's a constitutional requirement that there'd be, that the time would be continued, would be calculated as part of their sentence. That's essentially what the bill is doing, if I'm reading it accurately. It's basically saying that while they're pending their aid and assist evaluation at the hospital, the time spent there is credited toward, as time served, toward their sentence. Is that, am I reading that right? Am I completely off?
Actually, Representative Hicks, I don't believe this bill addresses credit towards time as time served. It has to do more with the amount of time that the hospital, the state hospital, has to restore a person to capacity.
Okay.
I do not believe this would change in any way how time is calculated in terms of ultimate criminal sentencing.
One more follow-up.
One more, okay. Referencing, though, B, paragraph, 2B, the defendant shall be given credit against each charge against the accusatory instrument for each day the defendant is committed under this section, whether the days are consecutive or interrupted, et cetera. And so that's where I'm getting my time served analysis.
And Representative Hicks, I believe that was added by legislative counsel to clarify that the same principles that exist now in terms of crediting time while a person's awaiting trial is applied in this instance.
Yeah, so essentially codifying existing practice.
I think it's trying to make sure that existing practice continues.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, thank you. Close the hearing on 7-432 and roll it over until Tuesday. Because people did not adhere to that, it's 3 minutes. He's got the clock. That's what you're going to have. Each one is going to testify the rest of the bills, or we will not get done. I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 519A.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, Senate Bill 519A pertains to affordable housing covenants. Basically, there are nonprofit organizations that purchase properties and then use them with a covenant on their ownership of the property that be used for affordable housing. Senate Bill 519 governs what happens when those properties go into foreclosure. Namely, it grants to these nonprofit organizations the first right to purchase the property for the lesser of the total sums of the obligations secured by the trust deed or mortgage on the property that is owed and due to all the persons have an interest in the property or the highest bid that comes in on that property other than from that nonprofit. There are two amendments that I anticipate may be discussed, the A6 and A7s, both should be contained in your packets.
Okay, can we have Jesse Beeson, Allison McIntosh, and Keith from DOJ?
Good afternoon. Mr. Co-Chairs, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of Senate Bill 519 and the A6 amendments. My name is Jesse Beeson. Today I represent both the nonprofit organization that I lead, Proud Ground, as well as the Northwest Community Land Trust Coalition and the Housing Alliance. Senate Bill 519 and the A6 amendments do a very narrow and specific but important thing, and that is to protect the public subsidy that is used in making a home affordable to low and moderate income families when that home is in foreclosure. In the interest of time, I won't go into details about that, but I'm, of course, happy to answer any questions. We consider many in the lending community to be our partners in this work. They work hand in hand with us to deliver traditional mortgages at fixed rates to our families. And we have worked with them since September of 2010, both with the Oregon Bankers Association and others, on crafting this bill and the A6 amendments. Because of this work in good faith and with fair compromise, I believe that we have kept the focus of Senate Bill 519 and the A6 amendments narrow and its implementation requirements very minimal. I stand ready to answer any of your questions, and again, thank you for the opportunity to express my support for the bill and the A6 amendments.
Thank you. Co-Chair Barker, Co-Chair Krieger, members of the committee, thank you for taking the time today to hear Senate Bill 519A. My name is Allison McIntosh, and I'm the Policy Manager for Neighborhood Partnerships, which convenes the Housing Alliance. The Housing Alliance is a coalition of organizations from across the state that have come together out of concern for those in our communities that don't have a safe, stable, and affordable place to call home. We have many tools and strategies that work to help Oregonians find places to call home, either in rental housing or homeownership. One effective Alliance's strategy to help first-time homebuyers is through a shared appreciation model, like a community land trust, where public and nonprofit investment lowers the purchase price for low-income homebuyers forever, keeping the home affordable for generations to come. This proven strategy works for many first-time homebuyers. However, in this difficult economy, foreclosure can happen to anyone, even those who've had public support. When foreclosure happens in this situation, public agencies and nonprofit organizations could lose all of their investment to a private investor. Senate Bill 519A and its -6 amendments solves this problem for both the bank and the nonprofit or public agency by creating the statutory opportunity to allow the nonprofit or public agency to purchase the home from the bank, keeping the public subsidy available for future first-time homebuyers and allowing the bank to recover its costs. This change will keep these investments working to ensure affordable homeownership options are in our communities. We urge your support of Senate Bill 519A and its -6 amendments. Thank you.
Chair Krieger, Chair Barker, my name is Keith Dubanovich. I am Chief of Staff at the Oregon Department of Justice. I'm here to speak with respect to the -7 amendments and only the -7 amendments. Let me briefly explain what the process is in Oregon for foreclosure, and it is either judicial or non-judicial. Judicial is you essentially present your papers in court to a judge, and the judge then determines whether the property could be sold. In 1959, almost as old as I am, the legislature adopted the process that allowed non-judicial foreclosure in the state. And that law requires that every assignment of an interest in that property be recorded before you can proceed with a non-judicial foreclosure. The -7 amendments would make a material change to Oregon law that's been in effect since 1959. Whether it is the correct policy choice is up to you folks, obviously, but it is fair to say that over the last 50-so years, there have been a number of judicial opinions that have addressed non-judicial foreclosure in this state, including an opinion yesterday that was issued by the Honorable Judge Panner, in which he clearly addressed what the requirements are for non-judicial foreclosure in this state. One of the recent opinions that I read, and I'll just simply quote briefly, is that the bankruptcy court opinion says that Oregon law that the -7 amendment would address only applies in non-judicial foreclosures. It does not at all change the requirements for judicial foreclosures. And according to Judge Alley, the chief bankruptcy judge, Oregon law is clear that it permits foreclosure without the benefit of a judicial proceeding only when the interest of the beneficiary is clearly documented in a public record. When the public record is lacking, the foreclosing beneficiary must prove its interest in a judicial proceeding. The -7 amendments would materially change that rule of law that's been in existence since 1959. And again, if that is your policy determination, it's certainly up to you. I speak simply to bring this issue to your attention to make sure that the interests of all parties are brought to you before you make any decisions on this amendment.
Thank you. Any questions, committee? Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Senator Bonifici, you snuck in here somewhere, you see.
Thank you very much, Co-Chair Krieger, Co-Chair Barker, committee members. I'm State Senator Suzanne Bonamici, representing Senate District 17, and I am one of the sponsors of the underlying Senate Bill 519A, which I believe is good sound policy, and I encourage this committee to move the bill forward without amendment. It's my understanding there's a -6 amendment that Senator Dingfelder's office has submitted, and I would support that. I just late this morning or mid-morning found out that there's a -A7 amendment, and I encourage this committee to not move forward on that amendment. This is a very complex issue and one that is currently being worked out in the courts. I believe I just walked in when Mr. Dabanovich from the Department of Justice was testifying. Just as recently as yesterday, there was an opinion from Federal Judge Owen Panner that deals with this issue. There have also been several other federal court and bankruptcy court opinions here in Oregon and across the country dealing with this particular issue. I wanted to read to you briefly from some testimony from an attorney named Phil Quarin, who couldn't be here today, but who has been studying this issue and working on it for quite a long time. Mr. Quarin was, about 25 years with a law firm in Portland and now has his own practice in Portland, and he is a specialist in real estate law. Excuse me. And I will make sure that you get this testimony in writing, but I just wanted to read to you. Mr. Quarin found out about the Dash 7 amendments and just sent this information, which I'd like to share with the committee. He also pointed out Judge Panner's opinion. Mr. Quarin says that the proposed amendment, meaning the Dash 7 amendment, will emasculate Oregon's trust deed foreclosure laws. We know that thousands of distressed owners have already been foreclosed by lenders who have ignored the current recording requirements. MERS, the lending and title industries, complain that commerce will come to a halt unless MERS gets its way and is allowed to do legally what it has heretofore done illegally. This is untrue. The lenders and services can prevent much of the title risks in their illegal foreclosures by doing them in conformance with Oregon law. And then he has some other suggestions, taking deed in lieu of foreclosure, consenting to short sales, etc. There are other ways that this can be resolved. Not every foreclosure will need to be a judicial foreclosure. Also, it's pretty clear that under the current statute as it is, there can be a non-judicial foreclosure as long as the assignments have been recorded. So I'm very concerned that this is an extremely complex issue. The mortgage electronic registration system has been around for about a decade or so. It's currently being considered in courts across the state and across the country, and for this committee to take a good bill that deals with very important affordable housing covenants and put this very complex issue in this bill, I think would be the wrong approach. This is something that the bill itself is something that's important policy in affordable housing. The amendment, I think, introduces a complex issue that is very separate and, frankly, attempts to legislatively overturn several recent federal and bankruptcy court opinions, and I don't think that's appropriate for this committee at this time.
You're okay with the Dash 6?
Yes, Co-Chair Krieger.
I think with Co-Chair's permission, I'm going to call a couple people up. I will probably put that amendment in today, carry it over. I want to check on one other little issue, but we do have two more people to testify. Does anyone have any questions of Senator Bonamici?
And Co-Chair Krieger, if I could just clarify, it's my understanding, and I'm sorry, I don't have the Dash 6 in front of me, it's my understanding that is the amendment that came from Senator Dingfelder's office. Yes. Is that correct, Mr. Knott?
That is correct, Senator.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I appreciate that, Co-Chair Krieger.
Thank you. Having Alan Brinkley and Paul Cosgrove come up, please.
Mr. Co-Chair and Co-Chair Barker, members of the committee, Paul Cosgrove representing the Oregon Financial Services Association and also appearing on behalf of the other members of the United Financial Lobby in support of the Dash A7s. I'll just start by, I think, correcting the record on a couple of things. Yes, there have been court decisions dealing with this issue, but the one the month before this month by a different federal district court judge sitting in Portland, Judge Jones, ruled the other way. So what you're faced with at the moment is a process where we have different judges in the state of Oregon ruling on what our state statute means in several different ways, and that's the problem that I think is before you, and that's why we believe it's important to address it now. It will take a great deal of time, years, to have the appellate decisions come down where all of these courts feed into the Ninth Circuit and have one common decision about what happens in these circumstances. And in the meantime, not only just with MERS loans, but in any case where there have been servicer agreements where the person who is servicing is not necessarily the owner of the note but has certain authority under an agency agreement to do certain tasks, the titles for all of those homes in Oregon are now clouded by the fact of these decisions. And we estimate, based on national data, that upwards to 80% of residential properties in Oregon are either involved with MERS or other servicing agreements where this legal theory that some courts have ruled one way and some another is involved in, and transfers of those properties by foreclosure or voluntary transfer are all in question. So that's the nature of the problem. That's why we bring you the issue in the Dash 7s. I would be happy to answer any questions, but I think, frankly, Mr. Brickley, who is with one of the title companies, can discuss exactly what we all thought the law used to mean before the first of these decisions came down and what we think you ought to do, recommend you ought to do to change our statute to make it clear that that is what the law is.
Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee, my name is Alan Brickley. I'm with First American Title Insurance Company in Portland, Oregon. I'm here to testify on behalf of or in favor of the Dash 7 amendments. It is absolutely correct that the decisions that have been rendered in the state of Oregon in the various courts, some of them have thrown into question the integrity of the title of people who have either foreclosed properties or purchased properties from lenders who have foreclosed. And it has created a significant issue for the title industry, certainly, and among others, the people who own these homes. The alternative that I understand is being discussed by some of the companies that process these foreclosures is the one that's already been mentioned, and that is the alternative is judicial foreclosure. I'm familiar as a result of some discussions at a seminar held last Friday that anywhere from 1,000, this is one foreclosing company, 1,000 are ready to be filed, and anywhere up to 4,000 will be filed sometime in the near future because of the uncertainty that's been created by these various decisions. The other, I would consider this an unintended consequence of the going to a judicial foreclosure as opposed to a non-judicial foreclosure, which is what most of them are today, is that in that 50-year period that's been previously discussed, and particularly in the last few years, there have been substantial changes to the non-judicial foreclosure process, which have created significant benefits for borrowers and consumers. And among those, I've mentioned in my testimony, but among those would include the enhanced notices, which include references to resources, the benefits for tenants, and other related items, modification notices, all related to benefiting the consumer. If the choice is made to go to a judicial process, every single one of those benefits that accrue to a borrower will disappear. They only apply in a non-judicial foreclosure context. The only thing that would be carried over is the inability to secure a deficiency judgment, that is the difference between the foreclosure price and the sales price or the debt at the time of the foreclosure sale against a person's personal residence. So, but all of the other benefits are going to disappear. The question is, you know, can they bring a judicial decision now? I mean, is that possible today? And the answer is certainly. All of these issues have been raised in judicial proceedings. The only difference is whether they answer in a foreclosure proceeding or they institute their own. So these amendments do not foreclose that opportunity. So the question is, what is the benefit of a judicial foreclosure? And the answer is, at least in my opinion, none, because it doesn't change the underlying debt. The obligation is still owed.
You've got 30 seconds. You're
the obligation continues to be owed, and the borrower is in the same position they were with additional costs associated with judicial foreclosure.
Okay.
Chair Krieger, members of the committee, my name is Hal Scoggins. I'm an attorney with Farley Wada Witt. We represent the Northwest Credit Union Association and many credit unions throughout the state of Oregon. And I'm here on behalf of the association in support of the A7 amendments. As consumer-owned cooperative financial institutions, credit unions are fully in agreement with Senator Bonamici's goals of fairness and transparency in the foreclosure process. And we believe this bill actually promotes that rather than detracting from that. And I'll speak to the part that deals with assignments of trust deeds not being recorded. The decisions that have taken place over the past few months especially have called into question a part of the statute that I think many people had already assumed reads the way that this amendment will want it to read now, which is to say that if a credit union makes a mortgage loan, sells the loan to Fannie Mae but retains the servicing, the credit union is listed in the trust deed as the beneficiary, even though Fannie Mae now owns the loan. Fannie Mae's procedure is they want to get an assignment of the trust deed from the credit union in case the credit union merges or is liquidated by its regulator or something like that. But it's not recorded because the credit union is still servicing the loan. That's the party that lien holders need to deal with. That's the party that the borrowers need to deal with. So the servicer is the party that is showing up in the record as the beneficiary. And this change will simply say that in the event that the servicer is conducting a foreclosure, it doesn't have to record the assignment that's sitting in the file as a safety precaution to Fannie Mae and then record another assignment back to the credit union in order to conduct the foreclosure, which is one thing that these decisions have thrown into question. And that's the procedure that's been followed for years, and I think it's been followed simply because many people believed that the effect of the statute is what we're amending it to read explicitly now, which is to say if you need to record an assignment to establish the identity of the person who's acting under the trust deed statute, then you have to record the assignment. But if that person is already of record as the beneficiary, then you don't need to record assignments that were made to other people and then record new assignments back to the person who's taking the action. That's the focus of our intent in at least this part of the A7 amendments.
Okay, committee members, any questions? Okay, thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Okay, we're going to take Senate Bill 519 and roll it over till Tuesday. There's a going check on the amendments and a couple of other people. So we'll close the public hearing. Representative Nolan had requested, is it 419? That 419 be carried forward, is that right, for a possible amendment? So we'll be rolling that over also until next Tuesday. So where are we at? 6:35. That's a work session. Right? Yeah. Going to open a work session on Senate Bill 6:35A.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, Senate Bill 635A makes two modifications to the general requirement that a private security personnel be certified. The first exception that it creates is for persons who work as security services, performing security services as a volunteer for an event operated for the benefit of a not-for-profit corporation. The second would be a student enrolled in a community college who is engaged in purely non-confrontational activities under the direct or indirect supervision of law enforcement. This is generally an individual who is performing sort of safety checks and is not allowed to make any direct contacts with an individual on campus who might be creating a problem. In its A version, 635A is expected to have no revenue or fiscal impact.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 635A to the floor with the due pass. Co-Chair Barker has moved Senate Bill 635A to the floor with a due pass. Any discussion on the bill? Call the roll.
Representative Olson. Aye. Representative Thomae. Aye. Representative Wise. Aye. Representative Wisman. Aye. Vice Chair Hicks. Aye. Vice Chair Garrett. He's excused. Co-Chair Krieger. Aye. Co-Chair Barker. Aye. Okay, Senate Bill 635A goes to the floor with a due pass. Anyone like to carry it? Hicks.
And we'll open a work session on Senate Bill 376A.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, Senate Bill 376A creates the new crime of aiding another person in committing suicide. There's a dash A5 amendment that I would call your attention to. This specifies that a person commits the crime of assisting another person to commit suicide if the person knowingly sells or otherwise transfers for consideration any subject or object that is capable of causing death to another person for the purpose of assisting the other person to commit suicide. It doesn't change the penalty of the bill. And I will note from conversations that occurred that the sort of purpose of that clause that is capable of causing death is to attempt to avoid a possible constitutional issue if there were sales of books or instructional pamphlets directed at how to commit suicide. As modified by the Dash 5 amendments, Senate Bill 376A is expected to have a minimal expenditure impact and no fiscal impact.
Staff, do you know if Senator Kalansky is okay with the Dash 5s?
Co-Chair Krieger, Senator Przanski was the proponent of the Dash 5s.
I would assume he would like them then.
I believe so.
Mr. Chair, move the Dash 5s into Senate Bill 376.
Co-Chair Barker has moved the A5 amendments into Senate Bill 376. Any discussion on the amendments? Objections? Amendments are in.
Mr. Chair, move Senate Bill 376 as amended to the floor to do pass.
Co-Chair Barker with Senate Bill 376A as amended the floor with a due pass. Discussion?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I should have said about the Dash 5s. This is from a recollection and reading what the Senator, this was the status of the bill when the Senator came in and testified. So, this does make a lot of sense to put these Dash 5s in, so I'm pretty sure he's going to be fine.
Okay. Anything else on the bill? Representative Nolan?
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I appreciated the testimony that we had the other day on this bill, and I cannot say how deeply I feel for the family of Mr. Klonowski. I know his mother. I can't even imagine what they have gone through. And I do not want companies to profit from preying on people who are at a vulnerable stage. But in evaluating that, I have to balance the interests of other people in the state, and in particular, the voters in this state have twice validated the part of the Constitution that preserves the right for individuals to control the manner in which they die when they are terminally ill. I am leery of the language in this bill, not its intent, but the actual language, which will, if it's passed, will survive any of us, and that's what will be interpreted, not what we had intended to do. And for those reasons, because I think it impinges on the rights of other people, I can't support the bill as it's amended.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I, too, support absolutely and completely the Death with Dignity Act we have in this state. Correct me if I'm wrong, but that's for folks that are terminally ill. This is about assisting people that are not. There's a clear distinction here, and I respect the good representative's opinion and her vote. God bless everybody, vote your heart. But my vote, in no way, shape, or form, in my opinion, undermines anyone's ability to take advantage of our Death with Dignity Act in this state. And that's why I'll be supporting this. Thank you.
Yeah, just along those same lines, I'm a strong supporter of the Death with Dignity Act, and would note that in order to have that performed, you have to have two doctors, you have to have, show that you're not depressed, and so on, and I think there's ample safeguards in that. This has no safeguards. This would allow a juvenile who didn't get invited to the prom, who thought the world had just ended, to send in their dad's credit card and get a suicide kit, and that is absolutely what we do not want. And just reiterate one more time that this does not affect and should never affect the Oregon Death and Dignity Act. Thank you.
Anything further? Can I call the roll, please?
No.
Excuse me.
Did we adopt the 8-5?
Yeah, we actually
did. Yeah, we did. I made my comment after the adoption.
Okay. Go ahead and call the roll.
Representative Nolan.
No.
Representative
Alston. Aye.
Representative Shaw.
Aye.
Representative Tomei.
No.
Representative Wong.
Jews.
Representative Woodman.
Aye.
Vice Chair.
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Garrett.
Aye.
Co-Chair Krieger.
Aye.
Co-Chair Parker.
Aye. Okay, Senate Bill 376A, as amended, should go to the floor if they do pass.
Carrier.
And we're going to need a carrier on this thing. You want to do it, Jeff?
Sure.
As I said earlier, we were going to work 409, but we're going to go ahead and carry that over for an amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I appreciate that accommodation.
Always. We're going to open a work session on Senate Bill 924.
And co-chairs, members of the committee, Senate Bill 924 changes provisions related to the revocation denial of licenses, tags, and permits for violations of various wildlife laws. There's some subsections here you may remember for having to failing to release a sturgeon beyond 6 feet in length, the unlawful taking of a raptor, commerce in regulated species. It gives specifications as to specific fines and penalties that must be imposed by the court upon those findings, and makes consideration for the existence of prior convictions. There is a Dash 8 amendment that has been advanced by the proponents of the bill, which I believe is operative, and they, I believe, are present to answer commentary about that that amendment as necessary. It's very new. We've only just received the minimal fiscal expenditure statement, and I believe there is also no revenue impact for that amendment.
I do have a question. They're saying the sturgeon over 6 feet. I thought that had been changed to 5.5.
That's the legal size is 5.5. Okay. So that would mean it would be a fish that is obviously too large, and there would have to be really an intent of mine.
Okay.
And they're taking those large females for the eggs to sell, so they've got more than one violation.
Okay.
Just a comment or two. I appreciate the people that have worked on the bill. It hasn't been easy. They've been very persistent. We did put a sunset on it, and I've contacted the state police, and they're going to take all the violations that are in there and try to keep track of those as we move forward, see what if the courts are following. Their concern was that not all of those violations are reported back to the state police from the courts. Well, there just happened to be a guy named Judge Paul Dimenez in my office this morning for another issue. He assures us that he will make sure they report. So I think we've got in place what we need to better protect some of these species that are important to us, and we'll be able to monitor that what we did is what we should have done, or do we need to modify it next session. So I would like you to pass the bill with the Dash 8s.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 8s into Senate Bill 924A.
Co-Chair Barker moves the Dash 8s into Senate Bill 924. Any discussion on the amendments? The amendments are in.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 924A as amended to the floor with the due pass.
Co-Chair Barker has moved Senate Bill 924A to the floor as amended. Any discussion on the bill? I'll call the roll.
Representative Nolan.
Mr. Co-Chair, not having had a chance to fully absorb the
2-8 amendment, which now becomes the bill. I'm voting yes now, but I'm going to read them before it gets to the floor.
You can ask a question.
I will. Thank you.
Representative Olson.
Aye.
Representative Schaffler.
In complete trust of the good co-chair and his ability to do this legislation, I will definitely vote aye.
Representative Tomei.
Aye.
Representative Wan.
Excused.
Representative Elizabeth.
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Harris.
Aye. Co-Vice
Chair Harris.
Co-Chair
Krieger.
Aye.
Co-Chair Barker.
Aye. Senate Bill 924, as amended, goes to the floor, and I'll carry the bill.
Makes sense.
What I did with, who was that? Asked me a question, will you yield? I said no.
Okay.
Okay, do we have what we need on 878?
We do.
Yes. Okay, I'll open a work session on Senate Bill 878.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, like Senate Bill 635, Senate Bill 878 modifies, makes exceptions to the generalized requirement that private security personnel be certified and licensed through DPSST. There are two more exceptions. The two here, first of all, new subsection G would be a person who monitors alarm systems that are not designed to detect threats to public safety or personal well-being. This replaces a previously existing exception with very similar language. The second, and the one that was certainly discussed more, is an individual who is controlling access at an entrance for an OLCC licensee. Just for the purpose of controlling access, this is subsection K. Now, there is a dash A4 amendment which clarifies sort of what an individual in that circumstance would be allowed to do. It clarifies that that person would not be armed, would not be permitted to initiate confrontational activities, and would not be hired with the primary responsibility of taking enforcement action as described. And then recall from the public hearing that this is making arrests or effectuating detentions. It also clarifies that this person is not regulating access at the entrance singular, but rather an entrance meant to accommodate establishments that may have one or more points of egress and exit. As amended by the dash A4s, Senate Bill 878 is expected to have a minimal expenditure impact and no revenue impact. We have not yet adapted that amendment.
Adopted. Mr. Perry? Just a minute, I've got clarity, make sure I'm not... We have how many amendments?
Just one, the A4 amendment to be adopted.
Are you okay with the A4s?
Yes, co-chairs, members of the committee, it does what we thought the bill did in the first place. So, yeah, we're fine with the A4s.
Identify yourself.
Oh, Bill Perry with the Oregon Restaurant Lodging Association.
All right, any questions, Mr. Perry? Thank you.
Hey, Mr. Chair, I move the A4 amendments into the dash 4 amendments into Senate Bill 878.
Richard Barker has moved the dash 4 amendments into Senate Bill 878. Any discussion on the amendments? Not on their end.
Mr. Chair, I move the Senate Bill 878 as amended to the floor to do pass.
Richard Barker has moved Senate Bill 878 as amended to the floor to do pass. Any discussion on the bill? Call the roll.
Representative Nolan.
Yes.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Representative Schaffler? Aye. Representative Tomei?
Yes.
Representative Wan?
Excuse.
Representative Lutnick?
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Harris?
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Harris?
Excuse.
Co-Chair
Krieger?
Aye.
Co-Chair
Barker?
Aye.
Senate Bill 878
moves
it
floor
as amended.
Representative Schaffler?
I'd be happy to.
Okay. You want to carry it?
I do all the work, and he carries the damn bill.
I think we got us have a co-carrier.
All right.
Sure. Co-carrier.
Oh, no, Mr. Co-Chair, I do not care.
Sounds like you care, Speaker. Sure.
I believe we're done for the day, staff.
Everything. Thank you.